Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to start out talking in this last hour with Doug Grotheis of Denver Seminary about how to write a letter to the editor. I mean, anyone can write a letter to the editor. You can pull out your crayon and scratch something off in a second. But will it not only get opened but read, taken seriously, perhaps even considered for publication? Get some advice from Dr. Grotheis on that subject. And then the last half hour of Issues Etc. today is Audio Open Lines. We just barely got through the first piece that we had put together. How many did we put together? Like 11 pieces for today. We always over-prepare. Why are we always doing this? Are we overachievers? Are we anal? Are we? Do we have some sort of problem here that we actually sit down and do...
It means we work less tomorrow for tomorrow's show.
We're working ahead.
Yes.
Okay.
So tomorrow we get in like at 2:30.
I never did that when I was in school. I never worked ahead. What?
Chuck will get in at 2:30.
I think if he's listening, he probably already knows your plan. So that's kind of one of the disadvantages of saying things like that on live radio. Well, we've got a lot of audio. We're just going to try and get through as much of it as we can in about 25 minutes here on Issues Etc. during Audio Open Lines. We managed to get one out of the way. And the next one we're going to be talking about is, what are we going to be doing? Oh, we're going to be doing the 60 Minutes piece that from this weekend on the Priory of Zion. Kind of goes with the whole Da Vinci Code theme that everybody's doing in the media. That's coming up in about a half hour here. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Issues Etc. is underwritten by LCMS World Relief. Have you been watching the news about the Darfur region of the Sudan, this peace treaty that is barely holding together, a country torn by civil war, religious persecution, you name it, it's got trouble with its neighbors, and there are hundreds of thousands of people living in the Darfur region in UN camps, and their situation is not only dire, it's also dangerous. LCMS World Relief is right there in that region, in the Sudan, helping people on the ground in the best way they possibly can, with concern for both body and soul, bringing the message of Jesus Christ along with what these people need, the very basic daily needs for their body and their life. That's what LCMS World Relief is all about, not only in the Sudan, but elsewhere across the globe. To find out more about them, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Their logo's right there on our homepage. Or you can call them and you can earmark your gift to LCMS World Relief for the Sudan, 1-888-930-4438. It's a toll-free call, 1-888-930-4438. Doug Grotheis is our guest. He's professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary. He's author of several books, including his latest called On Jesus, and he's also written an article in a recent issue of the Christian Research Journal titled How to Write a Letter to the Editor. Dr. Grotheis, welcome back.
Good to be with you again, Todd.
How would you respond to somebody who says, look, it's simply a waste of time to put pen to paper or to sit down at your laptop and write a letter to the editor? The print media is run by a bunch of liberal elitists, and Christians should simply disengage that entire scenario.
Well, I think that's giving up too soon. It is very liberal, certainly, but there's a window for influence, and one of those windows is the letter to the editor. And if you look at major newspapers or your local newspaper, you'll find typically a fairly wide diversity of opinion represented in the letters to the editor. And I've discovered over the years that if you stick to several basic principles, you have a fairly good shot at getting your letter printed. And if you stick to the other principles I give, the letter might be worth reading.
All right, let's talk about a few of those principles, beginning with, I think, one that goes for all writing, whether it be a letter to the editor, but write something that you know, you understand, you feel strongly about, and upon which you can express yourself clearly. Talk about that bit of advice.
Right. A lot of letters to the editor are not carefully focused. They're basically all over the map, and sometimes they simply parade people's ignorance. So you shouldn't write about something about which you can't say something intelligent. And I think feeling strongly about it is important because you've only got about 100 to 200 words to work with. And you want it to be very sharply focused. You want it to have a bite to it, so to speak. And you want to be able to express it in such a way that it makes a mark on the person who reads it. There's really no reason to write anything unless it's going to make some kind of a difference. And unless you take it to be true and that it is rational. So a lot of letters to the editor are, frankly, a waste of time. But some of them make a very strong, significant argument in just 100 to 200 words. And I think if people follow a few basic principles, they can learn how to do that.
100 to 200 words is a really short missive. I mean, it really is. Right. And I think people, when they get on a subject they do understand, that they do feel strongly about, that they can express themselves clearly on, have a hard time holding it to that length. Give us some advice on how to keep it short and sweet.
Well, discipline. You do it through practice. I've written long books. I've written academic articles that are fairly long. I've written editorials, and I've written letters to the editor. And each one requires a particular kind of discipline. So basically, you just try to make one salient point. Make it very clearly. Leave out all excess words. And use that word counter. And you absolutely must not go over the limit that the newspaper gives you, because they will not give you a special break unless you're a politician or a celebrity or something like that. You have to work within their word limit.
Well, if they want you to be a featured writer like a politician or a celebrity, they'll just ask you to write an editorial, won't they?
Typically, although sometimes they will give a few hundred more words to somebody who's more well-known.
Okay, so in other words, when you look at the paper and you find it's in almost every reputable publication has some sort of standards that they use for letters to the editor, and they're very clear about it, take those seriously.
Exactly. Yeah, some people think that if their letter is extraordinarily good, people will give them a break. Or some people just think that, well, I need to express myself, and I don't need to go by anybody's standards. That's just a waste of time. You've got to go with the standards even to have a chance of getting your letter published.
Okay, you said this before, but you have written that, like a good sermon, a good letter to the editor should be a bullet, not buckshot. What do you mean?
Yeah. Well, again, just one central and memorable point. You shouldn't just be flailing about in every direction simultaneously. Make one point. For instance, I wrote a letter to the editor a couple of years ago when a school in Colorado was going to start teaching yoga, public school now. And my basic argument was that yoga is a religion. Religion cannot be advocated in the public schools. Therefore, you should not advocate yoga in the public schools. That was it. Two premises and a conclusion. One argument, 100 words.
Now, someone says, look, but the problem is everyone thinks the problem is so simple, and it's far more complex than that, and I have to point out the complexity of this problem. Someone wants to write about this, just for the sake of discussion here, say someone wants to write about the situation in Iraq.
Right.
And they've got, I can't keep it to one point. I've got 5 points that have to be made for anyone to understand the real nature of the problem. Should they be writing a letter to the editor?
Well, maybe not, or maybe take one of those points or start a blog. And write all 5 points, or better yet, if you're a good writer, write an editorial where you get about 500 to 700 words.
Now, one of the things that we often encounter here when we're dealing with listeners or sometimes even guests, Dr. Grotheis, is that we have a hard time nowadays thinking critically, thinking clearly in a linear fashion, in a logical fashion. Now, I know, being a professor of philosophy, this is a subject near and dear to your heart.
Yes.
How would you counsel the would-be letter to the editor writer on making this thing make sense?
Well, read good books. Read thoughtful books. It wouldn't hurt anybody to go out and read a basic book on logic, a basic book on writing. That certainly glorifies God when we use our God-given minds to communicate truth. And simply having a warm heart is not sufficient to communicate truth clearly in the public realm. So people can help you, obviously, if you have a friend who is a good editor or a professor or something like that. It's very important to have your work edited. Almost everything that I write is edited by my wife. Now, I'm blessed in that she's a professional editor and writer herself. But find somebody who's used to working with words, used to working with ideas. Have them look at it. That helps. Just read good, thoughtful books, and reading a classic book on writing, let's say Elements of Style by Strunk and White. That's excellent. You know, a basic primer on logic and argument, something like that. That's extremely helpful as well.
I mean, even things as simple as getting your words spelled correctly?
That helps. Yeah, I mean, it's discipline, intellectual discipline. And sadly, in the church, we oftentimes don't have enough intellectual discipline, or we think that that's for the eggheads. The average Christian doesn't need that, but Jesus said to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. So he certainly included the cognitive dimension in his call to discipleship. And here's an area where we can express it in a very simple way, a letter to the editor.
I've read the letters to the editor, especially those that come from a professed Christian perspective. And very often, they are more emotive than they are anything else. The person obviously feels strongly, but that's all they seem able to express.
Right, and that doesn't carry a lot of weight in the public sphere because we have a lot of people out there emoting. We have a lot of special interest groups who hold to the decibel theory of truth. You know, the louder you yell, the more likely you are to be taken seriously, supposedly. But that's not the case. We have to present what we take to be true wisely. And as Jesus said, be wise as serpents, innocent as doves. So writing a letter to the editor, be wise as a serpent, you've got 100 words. You know, stick to it and be innocent as a dove. Don't use it to insult people, to brag about yourself, to whine about things, to claim that you're a victim. Use it to make one basic point that you think needs to be made in the public sphere.
You just mentioned bragging about yourself. Someone's going to say, look, I have some credentials. Let's say, again, on the subject of the situation in Iraq, maybe they've served time with the military in the Middle East, and they do have some experience in these things.
Right.
How far do you go in your introduction to your subject in laying out your qualifications to make the point?
Well, that's part of the classic discipline of rhetoric, the ethos, the position of the writer to gain approval or to show one's authority. That's legitimate. But what I worry about is when people are just trumpeting their credentials in an unwise way. So if your life experience or your achievement bears on the subject matter, then it's pertinent. That's a legitimate use of ethos. And you have to make a wise judgment on that.
When it comes to logic and presenting a cogent argument or a cogent point, what should be avoided?
Well, anything extraneous, anything off the point, anything that will unnecessarily confuse people. When Christians are writing to a journal or a newspaper that has a lot of non-Christian readers, they need to avoid Christian jargon, Christian in-group language. So let's say even the word sin. We know what the word sin means to some extent, I hope, but a lot of non-Christians don't. They have a concept that a sin is anything you find enjoyable or some kind of a taboo. We might want to use other words like the human tendency towards selfishness or egoism or something like that, if that conveys the meaning we're after in that particular letter. But we have to be very careful to not use jargon in a publication that will be read by non-Christians who will not understand the meaning of the jargon.
This can really be a test, that little endeavor can really be an exercise in self-evaluation. If you can't explain a term, a Christian term,
right,
you probably don't understand it yourself, do you?
Oh, I don't think so. In fact, C.S. Lewis made that point in his classic essay, Christian Apologetics, which has been anthologized in the book God and the Doc. He says, if you can't explain a doctrine in simple language to a layperson, you do not know what it means.
We're talking with Dr. Doug Grotheis about how to write a letter to the editor. He's professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary, author of several books, including his latest called On Jesus. And he's also written an article in a recent issue of the Christian Research Journal titled How to Write a Letter to the Editor. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address. You can go ahead and email us. Don't worry about getting it in 100 to 200 words. We'll be a little loose on that here. Issuesetc@kfuo.org. But as usual, the shorter, the better. What kind of letters? You talk about ineffective letters. Just avoid them altogether. Avoid them altogether. Give us some examples of ineffective letters to the editor.
Well, it'd be letters where someone is just venting, where they're obviously very angry and they're trying to get even with someone. They're just trying to get something off their chest. There's really no argument there. So I think really, as Christians, we should be people who speak the truth in love, Ephesians 4:15, in the church and to the world. So let's save the venting for some other place. Let's try to present truth in the marketplace that makes a difference. So any kind of a venting letter, any letter that's disorganized, any letter that's illogical, any letter that's unclear, any letter that uses a lot of jargon, any letter that just tries to puff up the letter writer, things in that general neighborhood are bad examples.
What about checking your facts?
Well, sure. Yes, you want to be clear that what you've said is true to the best of your knowledge. So you shouldn't just say something, you know, you heard somebody say 5 years ago. You should be able to back up what you say. Because sometimes with letters to the editor, there will be responding letters in a few days, and what you say may be challenged. In fact, someone might write you an email. Someone, it's possible, might even call you up. I've had people sometimes phone me after letters to the editor. So you need to be able to back up what you say. Whether or not anybody checks it out, you need to have a good conscience before God, and you shouldn't be loose with your tongue, and you shouldn't be loose with your word processor either.
One thing I've found, and this is just goes with the territory of doing a radio program, Dr. Grotheis, because it's a dynamic kind of means of communication, things get said, and once they're said, people have to depend upon, even before the days of internet audio and archived audio, had to depend on the memory of what Wilkins said. I will often get letters from people, letters to the editor of a kind, where I am taken to the woodshed for something I didn't really say.
Mm-hmm.
I was either misunderstood or misheard.
Mm-hmm.
So how important is it for those who are writing letters to the editor, especially if they're responding to something they read in that paper, to make sure mm-hmm. that they're actually reacting to something that someone actually wrote or said?
Well, it's terrifically important. Just go to the golden rule. We should treat others as we would want them to treat us. So if I've gone into print or I've said something publicly, I want people to listen to what I've said and to get it right. So I should exercise the same respect to another person, definitely.
How quickly, I've learned that when writing, especially when writing email, it's always best to wait a little while to respond to something, especially if it's gotten your dander up a little bit. But how quickly should the prospective letter writer respond to something he's read?
Well, within a day or two, typically. Now, what you said is very important. You don't want to be angry and just dash off a letter that you're going to regret if they print it. But at the same time, the newspaper really works on a deadline. So you can't wait more than a day or two, typically, to respond to an article or something else in the newspaper and have a chance of getting it published. Probably 48 hours at the maximum.
Is it necessary, Dr. Grotheis, if a Christian is writing a letter to the editor, that they identify themselves as a Christian in each and every case?
No, not at all. Some cases it's relevant, some cases it isn't. Some people, when they read a letter that says, as a Christian, they'll just stop reading it because they think, oh, here he goes again, or here she goes again, whining, complaining, fuming about something. In some cases, it's very pertinent. In other cases, it isn't. So you've got to make that judgment. Again, back to ethos, is it significant to say you're a Christian? If you say, I'm a Christian and I'm always offended when the non-Christians say this, well, you've lost 95% of your audience already.
What are your thoughts on Christians, when they write these letters, quoting the Bible?
Well, if it's appropriate, I think it's certainly worth doing. There's nothing wrong with that, obviously. Now, it needs to be well done. It needs to be clear. It needs to make a point. And it shouldn't just be thrown out there as a kind of weapon, so to speak. But certainly, if it fits, then why not?
What do you mean when you say use persuasion, not just proclamation?
Well, just giving arguments, trying to support a claim with reasons. That's classically what an argument is. Oftentimes people will state what they believe. As a Christian, I believe this, and it goes against what your newspaper says. And that's the end of the letter. Well, okay, now we know your opinion, and your opinion is against the newspaper, but does the person reading have any reason to believe that the Christian opinion is true? So we want to say what's true, but we want to back up what's true with reasons. That's what I mean by persuasion.
Now, I have a sardonic sense of humor. I can be very sarcastic, and that comes across sometimes in what I write. In fact, most of the time when I'm editing myself, I go through and just I write first in sarcasm, and then I have to go and translate it into something that is less annoying. And my wife is a pretty good she's got real sensitivity to her husband's sarcasm,
right,
whether he's writing it or saying it. But it can be used judiciously. What's your advice?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, really, there's a lot of barbed humor in the Bible used by godly people. So I don't have a hard and fast rule, but sometimes a really good zinger, a good one-liner, is a way to awaken people's attention. Now, it may be just showing off your own wit. It may be ad hominem. You're attacking the person and not dealing with the argument. But in some cases, a line that shows the absurdity of something may be very humorous and also be a powerful argument. I think Jesus was the master of that, frankly.
What are the real prospects of any average Christian writing to a major market newspaper of getting something published? How realistic should we be about our prospects of publication?
Well, if you stick within the guidelines, that increases the likelihood. If the newspaper is on the smaller side, of course, that increases the likelihood. If you're writing to the New York Times, your likelihood, just humanly speaking, is very small because they probably get tens of thousands of letters. I have never been published in the New York Times. I did get something published in the New York Times magazine once. But the bigger it is and the more secular it is, the smaller your chances are going to be.
How many letters, with only less than a minute, how many letters to the editor do you think you have written in the past years, Dr. Grotheis, and how many of them actually made it onto the page?
Oh, just the past year?
No, in your career of writing letters to the editor.
I have no idea, but probably it spans about 30, 35 years. I'd say about maybe 70%. I can't give you hard numbers.
Does it help to have Dr. Doug Grotheis, Ph.D.? Does that help?
It may help a little bit.
It might help more than a little bit. I don't know. But thank you very much for your advice, Dr. Grotheis. And thanks for being a diligent letter writer and reader and for helping our listeners.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Dr. Doug Grotheis is professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary, author of several books, including his latest on Jesus. And he's also written an article in a recent issue of the Christian Research Journal titled How to Write a Letter to the Editor. When we come back from this break, we've got audio open lines to round off today's program. We're going to hear a 60 Minutes piece, Ed Bradley talking about one of the claims of the Da Vinci Code book, that the Priory of Zion is an ancient thing. He went and checked it out. We'll find out what he found out after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What impact do teachings like creation, the fall into sin, the cross of Christ, law and gospel, simultaneously saint and sinner, the Word of God, baptism, and the Lord's Supper have on everyday life? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is titled A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about A Theology to Live By on our website, issuesetc.org. The cost is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Luther's theology is not abstract speculation, but teaching with a practical application for the real Christian life. A Theology to Live By, Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian, by Hermann Preuss, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Refuting compromise. The ark was too full? Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a planetarium and a large museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, some Christians claim that Noah couldn't have fit all the animals needed on the ark. Was it really big enough?
You know, Mark, I ask a different question. Why was the ark so empty? Now, that may come as a shock to people, but the ark was much bigger than needed to carry representatives of all the animal kinds on board. You see, Noah didn't have to take all the species of animals we observe today. There can be many species within a kind. For instance, there are many species of ducks, but our observations of ducks lead us to believe there's only one kind of duck. Noah just needed the duck kind on the ark. After the flood, as ducks and other creatures spread over the earth, different species form from the genetic information in the duck kind. Noah only needed a few thousand animals, leaving plenty of room for people and supplies. While the ark door stood open for the last 7 days, I think Noah was telling people, there's plenty of room on the ark. You know, today, Jesus is our ark of salvation, and there's room for you.
Ken Ham has written a fascinating booklet on Noah's flood and Noah's ark, and it's available free on our website. Next time you're on the Internet, visit us at AnswersRadio.com. You'll be built up in your faith, and you'll find some great evangelistic tools at AnswersRadio.com.
In Acts chapter 20, Paul professed that he had proclaimed the whole will of God to his hearers. Did the Apostle Paul know everything there was to know about God? Here's what Pastor Bill Simmons said on the Bible study.
If you are speaking about the totality of God's will and wisdom, absolutely not. Even the smallest part of his wisdom cannot be comprehended or contained. But in terms of the revelation of the will of God that St. Paul has been given, he has withheld nothing. And we know by divine inspiration and revelation, such as was the case when Jesus called him on the road to Damascus. Nothing has been withheld. Everything has been taught and given to them. Now, they did not have the benefit of the written word that we have because these writings were just in the process of being penned and would not be gathered for some time yet. But he has verbally shared with them the revelation of the will of God that has been given to him, that they might share in the same teaching that he has been given.
Listen to the Bible study, weekday mornings at 10:05.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive. The folks at Reliable Heating and Cooling remind you that during this in-between season, between the extremes of winter and summer, it's generally easier to arrange for a service checkup on your furnace or your air conditioner. That tip courtesy of Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive, a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Let's do a quick check of our Issues Etc. email account, issuesetc@kfuo.org. A couple emails coming in a little bit late from a previous segment of Audio Open Lines. I think they're both on the subject of Joel Osteen. Mark from St. Louis writes, I just heard portions of Osteen's talk with Katie, referring to Katie Couric. Something's wrong when Couric preaches the gospel and Joel does not. It's true. Now, I don't know if Couric actually got to the gospel, but she certainly had more theological substance. There's an irony for you. Katie Couric with more theological substance than her guest, Joel Osteen. Here's another one. This one from Janice in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Talk about going from one end of the spectrum to the other, Pastor Todd. Maybe if Job had only read Your Best Life Now, he wouldn't have had so many troubles. Nice way to celebrate that Old Testament Saints Commemoration Day, Joel Osteen's book. It's 2395, Book of Job, priceless. That's what she writes. Thank you very much, Janice. Very nice to hear from you at issuesetc@kfuo.org. Hey, that's true. Joel could give advice to the best of them if he'd only known those seven principles for achieving success now. He wouldn't have ended up the way he did, or at least spent that time sitting on the ash heap the way he did. Thanks, Janice. It's Audio Open Lines. Our calling numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You know, I could just take off and let the listeners host the show because they have pithier, better responses than I do.
They won't work for your money.
Oh, I think they would. I think they probably would. But actually, we haven't really stated this, but every good idea that you send to us via the email, I feel at liberty to steal without attribution, really. Or maybe I'll just say, some listener once said. That's all the more you're going to get out of me, I promise. Some listener once said, I think, or maybe I said it. After enough years goes by, I might even be taking credit for it. Who knows? This was interesting. There are a lot of factual, quote-unquote, factual statements made in the Da Vinci Code. In fact, most of the chapters begin with some statement of fact. Fact, this is really true. And Dan Brown has said that everything except the characters in his fictional book, The Da Vinci Code, everything except the characters is factual. The only fictional part are the characters themselves. Well, one of the statements of fact made in the Da Vinci Code book has to do with the group called the Priory of Zion. If you're watching 60 Minutes on Sunday night, you may have seen this from Ed Bradley investigating one of these statements of fact in Dan Brown's novel.
One of those alleged facts is featured prominently at the beginning of the Da Vinci Code. On a page headed Fact, Dan Brown says that the Priory of Zion, which is central to the secret at the heart of his book, is a real organization. He says that in Paris, at the Bibliothèque Nationale, the French National Library, you can find proof that it was founded in Jerusalem at the time of the Crusades. That proof is in some documents known as the dossier secret, or secret files.
Voici les dossiers secrets.
Merci, monsieur.
So we decided to check out those secret files for ourselves. The Bibliothèque Nationale made exact copies for us to look at, because they said the originals were too fragile to handle.
We soon found what we were looking for. This document gives the history of the Priory of Sion dating back to the 12th century. And there's a list of Grand Masters that includes such illustrious names as Sir Isaac Newton and Leonardo da Vinci. This information would be astounding except for one thing. In your opinion, is that true?
No, it's completely false.
Jonathan Riley Smith is the former professor of ecclesiastical history at Cambridge University and a leading authority on the Crusades.
I do know what was going on in Jerusalem in the 12th century. I do know that. I spent 40 years working on it. And what these people say did not happen.
French researchers have also questioned the authenticity of these secret files ever since they were deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale in the 60s. Their attention came to focus on a man named Pierre Plantard, seen here with his young son in Paris in 1979. Plantard claimed to be the current Grand Master of the Priory of Sion. But evidence at the police headquarters in Paris tells a different story. Historian Claude Charlot, who is director of police archives, says there's a file on Plantard, who died in 2000, showing that during World War II he was investigated by the secret services. So what was their conclusion?
The investigation said he is a young man whose mind, as we say in French, is cloudy. He is a fantasist. He is not a serious person.
One of Plantard's fantasies was to set up right-wing anti-Semitic organizations, similar in style to medieval orders of chivalry. But in reality, these organizations existed only on paper.
That's Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes exposing one of the statements of fact in Dan Brown's novel to be not as factual as he claims it is, this whole issue of the Priory of Zion being some sort of ancient order. And if that's called into question, if in fact this is just a group invented in the mind invented in the mind of someone who lived less than 30 years ago, then when you see the Priory of Zion involved in the cover-up in Dan Brown's novel of the truth about Christianity, you could probably also call that into question. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. Just trying to make sure that when you go in to the theater in the coming weeks to see Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, that you're equipped with at least the facts, so that you can distinguish fact from fiction. That's all it really is, just distinguishing. You don't have to stand up and throw anything at the screen. You don't have to yell out in the middle of the movie, untrue, untrue. Just take it for what it is. Fiction. Well, the Vatican and China are at odds, real odds, over the appointments of some bishops in that country. Here's more from National Public Radio.
Pope Benedict XVI has come into open conflict with the Chinese government. China this week ordained two bishops without the Vatican's approval. The Pope called the ordinations a great wound to the unity of the Church. The conflict is a major setback to ties between the Vatican and Beijing, which had made some progress towards establishing diplomatic relations. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us from Beijing. And, you know, there's talk of excommunication, but what does that mean? What happens now to these bishops that are ordained by China's official Catholic Church?
Well, I don't see what way there is that they can escape the Church's stiffest penalty, which is excommunication, because according to the Church's laws, the two new bishops who were ordained without the Pope's approval and the two bishops who did the ordaining are automatically excommunicated, which means they're still Church members, but they're not allowed to give or receive communion. The Vatican has opposed the consecration of both these clerics all along. It thought that they were either unqualified or not loyal enough to the Pope. But China's official church, the Patriotic Catholic Association, went ahead anyway and ordained these two bishops, one on Sunday and another on Wednesday.
And how are the Vatican and the Chinese government, if you will, presenting their cases?
Well, the Vatican said in a statement that Pope Benedict was profoundly displeased to learn about the ordination and called it a violation of religious freedom. The Vatican statement also expressed concern about reports that authorities in China outside the Church coerced Catholic clergy to participate in the ordination. And the Vatican is also worried by reports that China is planning to ordain many more bishops, as many as 20 perhaps, without the Pope's permission. For Beijing's part, the official church has denied any official interference in the bishop's selection. It says that the local Catholic congregations in China chose their bishops democratically, as they usually do. And China's foreign ministry has said that it remains sincere about improving ties with the Vatican.
Well, the two sides have been trying to establish diplomatic ties. Considering this, and it is the official Catholic Church, so say what the government will, you know, it would seem it would have some influence. What happens now to these efforts?
Well, it's clearly a very big setback for the efforts to establish ties, but I think it also shows what a flimsy foundation this apparent rapprochement by the two sides was built on in the first place. Now, let's remember that the Vatican still recognizes Taiwan and not mainland China's communist-led government. One reason people thought things were about to change is that the Vatican has said it's willing to break off ties with Taiwan and recognize Beijing instead. The other reason is this issue of the selection of bishops. Now, over the past two decades, the Vatican has been quietly approving bishops within China's official church, and Beijing just quietly played along. So most of Chinese bishops are now approved by both the Vatican and Beijing. And this has helped to heal the rift between the underground church, which is loyal to the Pope, and the official church, which is loyal to Beijing. The problem is that this was never a mutual agreement. It was always a sort of don't ask, don't tell arrangement in cases where they could both agree on the same clerics. Now the disagreement over these two clerics is out in the open, and this tacit arrangement has completely collapsed. And so we're back to square one, with each side claiming it has the sole authority to ordain bishops.
Thank you very much. NPR's Anthony Kuhn speaking from Beijing.
All right, there's the story. Now, this might sound like a minor thing, but it isn't. First of all, dealing with the Vatican, when they're talking about diplomatic relations, the Vatican has its own authority as a nation state to deal with the government of China. And the big question in my mind is, to what degree is this official church, the Patriotic Catholic Association in Red China, to what degree is it just a functionary of the communist government? I've heard people complain about these churches, and if you are not part of the official state church in China, see, this is how they get around accusations that religious freedom is not practiced in China. They say, hey, we've got the Patriotic Catholic Association. We have official state churches. The problem is, if you're not members of them, you pretty much have to do church underground. in China. So it's probably high time that the Vatican stopped this, the tacit agreement with this church, and dealt with this, tried to sort out whether or not this is just another arm of the government or, in fact, a genuine bona fide Catholic organization inside China. On that subject, the U.S., we've talked about this before, this U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom issued its annual report last week, and we heard a little audio on that. It sharply criticized several U.S. allies. Guess who? Now, the commission lists 11 countries of particular concern. They're called CPCs. If you hear that, that means these countries are not practicing religious freedom. In Saudi Arabia, by the way, it said religious freedom does not exist. That's a pretty strong statement. Now, the chairman of the commission is Michael Cromartie. We heard him not too long ago on the program. Here he is with Bob Abernathy of Religion and Ethics News Weekly, a PBS program.
The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom issued its annual report this past week, sharply criticizing several U.S. allies. The commission lists 11 countries of particular concern. In Saudi Arabia, it said, religious freedom does not exist. The chairman of the commission is Michael Cromartie. Michael, welcome.
Good to be here.
As you study these things and travel around the world, is the state of religious freedom on this planet getting better or worse?
Well, tragically, Bob, I think it's getting worse. And I think one of the reasons is that there is a religious explosion in the world, great interest in religion, and charismatic and Pentecostal Christianity is growing around the world. Islam is actually a growing religion. Sometimes these religious traditions are seen by the state as a threat, because these are people who feel that their God calls them to have a loyalty to their God as opposed to the state. So this, the state is, becomes concerned that it can't control its own people. Mm. As a result of that, they sometimes torture these people, they persecute them, and oppress them. And so with the growth of religion around the world and religious interest, these states seem to be trying to suppress some of them.
Mm-hmm. Is there one country that's worse than any other?
No doubt, Bob, that North Korea is the worst country in all the world with human rights abuses, religious persecution. It's really hell on earth in North Korea. The commission, by the way, put a report out on North Korea, and it's just even hard to read.
Mm. Yours is an advisory commission. It advises the Secretary of State, Congress, the President. After you put it out, does anybody do anything about it?
Well, we're delighted, Bob, to know that when you put out a 200-page report, that in fact not only do our people in the State Department and in the White House and the Congress read it, but we found that other countries read the report, and their diplomatic embassies and people in their on their staff are concerned that they're on these lists.
But it seems to me to run right up against some of the national security interests, against terrorism, against our need for oil. If you say Saudi Arabia is a place where religious freedom does not exist, so what?
The fact of the matter is, Bob, you'd be surprised to know that, in fact, diplomatically behind the scenes, we put a lot of pressure on Saudi Arabia for its human rights abuses and its repression of religious believers there. And that is good news.
Okay. Michael Cromartie of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
That's PBS's Religion and Ethics News Weekly. I'm interested listening to that short interview on kind of the harshness of the statements made in this Religious Freedom Commission's report. First of all, he was very blunt. He called the North Korean situation, they are the chief offender, without a doubt, hell on earth. Difficult to read the part of the report that deals with North Korea. And then to say that Saudi Arabia, that in that country, in that ally country, by the way, religious freedom doesn't exist. See, here's one of the unpaid bills that we're going to have to face in the Middle East. And that is, in Islamist countries, there will be no religious freedom, not even remotely resembling what we enjoy here in the West or elsewhere. So do we turn a blind eye to it? Is it enough simply just to write a report every year and say, here are countries of particular concern, including many of our allies, and then let it go? Now, sure, you can use these things to apply pressure. Will anything change? That's my question. It's audio open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. People are concerned. We were recently in Dearborn, Michigan. Dearborn, Michigan has the distinction of being the one city in the United States that has the largest per capita population of Muslim immigrants and Muslims, period. You go up there and you ask people about Islamic issues, they will talk about it because they deal with it every day. That's just one city in the U.S., however. One of Germany's largest states is using a mandatory questionnaire. It's aimed at trying to make sure that immigrants from Islamic countries are able and willing to assimilate into the German culture, into the German values, into the German social system. Let's hear more about it. This comes from National Public Radio.
While the United States deals with questions about immigration, Germany is facing its own immigration issues. State ministers met in Berlin yesterday to discuss setting new national guidelines on immigration and naturalization. One option is a controversial new naturalization questionnaire being used in one German state. It aims to test immigrants' attitudes toward Western democracy and its values. NPR's Rachel Martin reports from Berlin.
The new citizenship questionnaire in Baden-Württemberg doesn't pull any punches. Do you think women must obey their husbands? And if they don't, should husbands be allowed to beat them? Do you think homosexuals should be allowed to hold high-ranking government positions? Do you think the September 11th attacks were committed by terrorists or freedom fighters? This is just a sample of the list of questions developed in Baden-Württemberg earlier this year and also adopted in the state of Hessen. Rainer Grell is with the Baden-Württemberg Ministry of the Interior.
Just because someone knows the difference between the lower and upper houses of parliament doesn't mean they accept our values as their own. We wanted to step back from the facts and figures and instead focus on people's attitudes.
In Germany's federal system, the individual states have primary control over immigration and naturalization policies. In Baden-Württemberg, applicants must sign a statement of loyalty to Germany. If immigration officials have doubts, the applicants can be called back in for an interview based on the new questionnaire. Grell says it was developed in response to a 2004 survey by a German research institute that said almost a quarter of Muslim immigrants believe Islamic law trumps the German constitution. Grell rejects criticism that the new questionnaire targets Muslims.
It's not the Muslim religion that we have a problem with, as long as Muslims believe in our laws and ideas about equality. If their belief collides with that, then we say you might be able to live here, but you cannot be German.
The state of Baden-Württemberg has the highest per capita immigrant population in Germany, most of them from Turkey. In the northern part of the capital, Stuttgart, a group of boys kick around a soccer ball outside an Islamic community center. Gurkay Sofulu is the director of the center and has led a campaign against the new naturalization process.
Ich war empört.
I was disgusted. Then I was angry. At the end, I was amused.
Sofulu says the questionnaire is unnecessarily provocative and targets personal values that have nothing to do with citizenship. Sofulu says anti-immigration policies like the questionnaire only deepen a growing and potentially dangerous divide between isolated Muslim youth and German society.
Und die identifizieren mit diesem Land nicht.
They don't identify with Germany, but they need some kind of identity, so they reach out to their home cultures, and they end up taking on more radical ideas and identities than teenagers in Turkey or Morocco.
Some Germans say immigrants have marginalized themselves by creating parallel societies where they can function without learning German and live according to their own values, which may include very different attitudes towards issues like the rights of women. Erhard Körting, a senator from Berlin, takes a different view. He says many of the immigration challenges Germany faces today are rooted in the guest worker programs of the 1960s and 70s that brought roughly 4 million immigrants to Germany without integrating them.
We realize now that these people are here to stay, and if that's the case, then we have to come to some reasonable way of living together. We told the people far too long that these people would come, work, and then go home.
Körting says the country needs to focus on education programs to teach immigrants German language skills, as well as human rights and cultural studies. He says for integration policy to succeed, immigrants have to make an effort to become part of the culture, but German society has to help them. That's a nice sentiment, says Gürkay Sofulu, himself a naturalized German citizen. But it's going to take a while before Germany will embrace its identity as an immigrant country and its immigrant citizens as Germans.
Ich kann nicht sagen, ich bin Deutsche.
Right now, I can't say I feel like a German, but I would be very happy if the next generation of immigrants could say with full conviction, I'm German.
The interior ministers of all the German states are meeting in Berlin to discuss setting federal standards for naturalization. Several options are under consideration, including the Baden-Württemberg questionnaire. Rachel Martin, NPR News, Berlin.
What do you think about this? Because, I mean, my first thought was, you know, that's not a bad idea they've got there. It really isn't a bad idea. Trying to see to it that immigrants of any stripe are willing to assimilate. Not asking them to give up their native culture or their home culture or family traditions or their religion, but to say, look, you come in here, this is the deal. This is the deal. It may have been unspoken before, but now we'll have to make it more specific. I don't know, is that going to make a difference when it comes to Islamic immigrants? Let's talk with Barry, who calls from Washington, D.C. Barry, welcome to Issues Etc.
Oh, it's a good program, as always. It's so good to hear it.
Thank you.
I'm going to be back in Iran this month. I'll be in at the end of the month. And I'm looking forward to speaking about Jesus Christ in Iran. And what I find is that not all of the countries are the same. Some of them do allow us to talk about Christ. They do have churches in that country. People can be Christians. Now, it would be a very serious offense to openly proselytize. But some of the Islamic countries will let us talk about our religion and about our theology, and some of them welcome it.
Are they mainly concerned? Let's talk about, did you say you're going to Iran?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are they mainly concerned about the possibility of a Muslim apostatizing and becoming a Christian? Is that their main concern?
That would be illegal, yes. That is a major concern.
So they're concerned about proselytizing on the part of Christians because it could lead to other crimes in their view. All right, Barry, thank you very much for the call. Well, there's the rationale. There's no doubt about the rationale. The question is, when we have Islamic allies, how much will we require of them as our allies and friends by way of religious freedom? This summer, coming up this summer, a very good opportunity for high school-aged men to get a taste of what it means to study for the pastoral ministry, possibly in the future even become pastor, Christ Academy 2006. For more information about this two-week residential program for high school-aged men on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, just go to our website, issuesetc.org. There's a logo for Christ Academy 2006 with all the information you need. You can also call and find out about it. 1-800-481-2155. That's the number for Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Ask about Christ Academy 2006. 1-800-481-2155. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. James Emery White, president of Gordon-Conwell Seminary, is going to be our guest. We'll talk a little bit about the Da Vinci Code. And Dr. Gene Edward Veith will join us to talk about putting Christ in Christianity. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.